This week on Earn More Tutoring, I talk with Jean Merle Adams about how she's able to charge only $1 to her clients to represent them as their special education attorney, how she left her job as a DreamWorks attorney to follow her dream of becoming a special education attorney, and her passion for Star Trek.
I went to my boss at DreamWorks, and she's the general counsel. I'm like, okay, I know you're gonna be suspect about this, but I want to be a special education lawyer. I'm gonna quit my job. And she's like, what? So she extended my contract for just a year, and she allowed me to work from home on Fridays so that I could develop a business plan. And that's what I did.
Welcome to Earn More Tutoring. I'm Sean McCormick, the founder of Executive Function Specialists, an online coaching business that helps middle, high school, and college students feel better organized. And I started this podcast to learn more from people like Miss Jean Adams, who's an expert on special education. So to introduce her, my guest today is Miss Jean Adams. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sean. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm so excited to have you here. I just read your book, The Top 5 IEP Mistakes and How to Avoid Them. And it was awesome. And I'd love for you to share a little bit of background about why you wrote this book. I know that, you know, it was a very personal reason. And I'd love for you to kind of share the synopsis with our audience so they can be more in tune.
Sure. Happy to. Over 20 years ago, I attended an IEP meeting for my son who had special needs. And at the time I was an executive working with a big movie studio. I didn't know anything about special ed, had no idea what to expect, but it was a horrible experience. Like, I think I still have post-traumatic stress, you know, even a few decades later. And sitting there in that meeting, you know, discussing my son and his needs, the school district person got up from the table, walked around, stood over my shoulder, yelled at me and told me I had to sign off on their plan. She didn't know I was a lawyer. She didn't ask. I didn't tell. She didn't know my husband, who was sitting next to me, was a physician. Nobody asked. Of course, I didn't sign off on a plan that was inappropriate. But sitting there, I thought, wow, you know, I can manage to get services for my son, but what about other parents who can't? So that was the moment Adams ESQ was born. And I decided to dedicate the rest of my career, which I have, to representing parents of children with special needs and ensuring that their children get services and supports that they're entitled to under the law.
I can't believe they were so foolish. I mean, to yell at you. I mean, just the idea of doing that to anybody is crazy. And I'm sure it happens more than I can even imagine. Even I'm a former special education teacher or still credentialed. I've seen some pretty contentious meetings, but to get up out of your chair and yell at you,
right,
that
here
is just unbelievable. Right, I mean, what was your thought in the moment? I mean, I'm sure there's that like fight or flight response. And then there's like, I'm a lawyer. You know, I mean, I'm about to, you know, we're going to figure this out on my terms.
Yeah. So part of me is like, girlfriend, do you know who you're talking to? Like in my head, like that was going on. But another part, remember, I was a mom. I was an older mom, but my kid was like 5. Right. And so when you're a parent in that situation, all you can think about is your child. Like you can't really process what's going on. And you assume when you go to the school district that you're going to get help. And you assume that the people in the meeting are, you know, all professionals who can help you. And Sean, I think for the most part, that probably is true, right? And you know, I'm going to say perhaps I got a rogue, you know, administrator that particular day. But in my head, it was, again, like, how can this be happening? You know, I'm going to get help for my kid no matter what. And I can do that. I have the means, I can do it. But what about parents who can't? The nice part of that story is that I did end up, you know, finding, you know, excellent, excellent service providers, paying for them myself, my husband and I. And my son grew up, went to college, graduated, and is doing quite well.
Yeah, that was the really beautiful part of the story. I believe you included kind of a little, I remember reading like about how he's grown up and he's doing great. And just the beginning, though, I think is so relatable to so many parents that I work with. I'm sure that you've seen that have come to you, that you love your baby, you know, or your child, right? You know, they're perfect in your eyes. And it seemed like, I can't remember exactly what you wrote, but there was something like your boy was also doing some very exceptional things, even at a young age. I think you said he could like read the ABCs or recite them like super early or whatever.
Tell us a little bit more
about that, because I think that's the part that a lot of people need to hear, is that like we all, you know, it sounds like he was doing some incredible things, and you don't obviously don't have to go into details about what his, you know, specific needs were, but what's that experience like for you and also parents who, you know, see how incredible their children are and then, you know, see how they're treated by the district, or, you know, it's just like, oh, they should be in this isolated classroom because they can't learn, you know?
I will say this, when you're a first time parent, it doesn't matter whether you're a doctor, lawyer, teacher. When it's your child, sometimes you don't see disability. Like, you just see your baby and, you know, you don't see disability, you don't hear disability, and you're not aware of it. So it was his teacher who actually pointed it out to me. And once she did, I'm like, wow, like I never even saw this. So part of it is, you know, it's from the parents' perspective, at least from my perspective, we didn't understand disability, right? And there's so many parents of children on the spectrum, children with, you know, attention deficit disorder, children with mental health needs, children with speech and language needs, who don't even recognize or understand that this is a problem, right? And this is a challenge, not a problem, but a challenge that needs to be dealt with. So part of it is on the, you know, from the parent's perspective, you know, you're kind of blinded by the beauty of your kid, right? And the perfection. And I just thought he was just perfect. He could read, you know, at 2.5 and, you know, just very bright. And we didn't do the TV thing. So, you know, we just had experiences and traveled. So it was, he went to a nice little school. So, you know, it really was a little bit of a surprise. You know, it was a lot of a surprise to learn that, oh boy, you know, there's challenges that really need to be addressed. I will say the good thing is teachers, experienced teachers are, you know, they're just at the front line, right? And parents have to be open to listening to them, but they, especially experienced teachers, they've seen so many children, they know what that kind of bell curve looks like. And so they can kind of pinpoint where your child is on that curve. And it's important to listen to them and especially seek intervention early.
Yeah, I mean, and when you say it, you know, I'm thinking of my own 2.5-year-old child. I'm like, wow, your kid could read at 2.5 and didn't watch any TV. I got some work to do. I want to keep improving my parenting practice. That's awesome. But you know, what I'm wondering about is, maybe you could walk us through, you know, for people who haven't read the book, they should read the book. I hope they do. And we'll put a link in the bio so they can visit your website and get a copy. What are the, you know, the thing, maybe walk us through, I know you've probably done this 1,000 times, but kind of walk our audience through, like, you know, if someone is in your shoes and they don't see any disability, which makes sense, and then their school's like, oh, they need an IEP, they need this. What, tell us, you know, kind of walk us through the kind of the high level view of how they should approach that.
I think the first thing is, again, listen to your child's teacher, right? And you have to listen very carefully. So typically, you know, and you know this, a typical school year is going to start in August, maybe early September. COVID has made that a little bit funky, but that's really sort of a typical school year. If your child has fairly moderate to severe needs, a a preschool teacher or pre-K kindergarten teacher is going to notice that pretty quickly, right? And certainly by that October, you know, first meeting with the parents. And so I think it's important for parents, again, to be receptive and to really, and to read between the lines a little bit. So if you hear something like, well, little Johnny is having a really hard time in circle time. He just cannot sit still. He cannot, you know, attend. That's something that is a red flag. It doesn't say, oh my gosh, he needs special ed, but it is something that parents really need to listen to. So first and foremost, be receptive and listen. Right? I would say that that's important. What's also important, number two, I'm a lawyer, right? So before I attended the IEP meeting for my kid, this is 20 years ago, like I did some homework, right? I'm like, okay, what's an IEP? What's special ed? What kind of services are available? And that's something that parents have to do immediately. Educate yourself. Educate yourself. We now have, you have my book. We also have a blog, so parents can sign up for our newsletter where we post once or twice a month about just new issues that we're seeing. And so that kind of titrates that information a little bit, so you're not like, ah. And school districts give parents, as you know, this packet, right, of procedural information, their notice of their rights. We find that most parents kind of glance through it, but don't really like embrace those rights. And it's really important to do so.
Yeah, those are great points. And I think for many parents, I know they trust their teachers, right? And it seems like even culturally, it might be different for each culture, right? Like, you know, I know with certain students, there's a deference, you know, to the teacher, like, oh, I shouldn't question them. What do you tell parents, you know, when they're scared to question the plan that's been put in place or they feel like they just need to go along with it? What do you, you know, how do you address that with them?
Right. So I think you're right, Sean. So from a societal standpoint, we have a very deep respect for our teachers, as we should. Right. And especially, you know, I was an A student, right? I'm a lawyer. So like, I love my teachers. The teachers love me. And so it was a shock when I found out that sometimes teachers, you know, aren't transparent, right? In terms of information, right? So I tell parents that your child's teacher might be fantastic. I mean, it might be really great, might be highly regarded, but they are not your baby's mom or dad, right? And that as a parent, you are his or her, their advocate, like their top defender. And you have to step in. You have to step up. You have to step into that role. Think of yourself as their defender, as their advocate, because, you know, depending on the severity of their needs and whether it's sort of mild, moderate, severe, you're going to have to, you know, strap on, you know, that armor and fight for a lot of years for the services and supports that they need.
Yeah, that's probably a tough pill to swallow for them, but it's important, you know, so important. And what I loved about your book was the, you know, special education is so complex. You know, I think about it all the time. I'm like, what really is the least restrictive environment? What does that really mean? You know, there's so many high level, almost philosophical concepts in special ed. And it's like an education in itself to consider them. And at the same time, I love your book is like around 100 pages. It's written in a very like, you know, friendly, not talk down, like here's a big word, you know, like very explanatory. So I think it's just an awesome resource for parents who are like, okay, I may have a kid in special ed or we may be going through this process. It just equips them like with that armor, like you said. It's an investment, right? You can't expect to really protect your child and to serve them if you're not willing to at least do a little bit of work. So I want to call out parents there and advocates, like, you got to do a little homework. Like, I know you, you know, maybe that wasn't the expectation. Have you felt pushback, you know, from parents? Like, no, this is, you know, have you experienced pushback, or do they typically kind of get on board and like, okay, I got to start learning, you know, reading?
They get on board, right? So parents who call me, I'm a lawyer, right? I'm like scary. Like, nobody wants to call me, just to chit chat. So parents who call me, they already have experienced a significant problem, right? Because it does take a lot of courage to pick up the phone and call a lawyer. And so I understand that. So in some respects, those parents are self-selected, right? And so that they already have experienced, you know, challenges in obtaining services, and they're already open and receptive to getting help. The book itself started as a presentation that I gave to a group of primarily monolingual Spanish-speaking parents in Nevada years ago. And, you know, people kept asking for more and more and more, and I started adding to it. And I said, well, this is a book, so might as well get it out there. One thing that I cut out of the book, where I made it a lot smaller. And if I do a new edition, I'm going to expand it a little bit more, is the history of special ed. I think it's so important that parents understand what it was like in the before times. Right? And many parents experienced that a little bit during COVID. Like, this is what it's like when, you know, you have a child on the autism spectrum, and there is nobody that's going to help you. Like, that's how it used to be. And so I think it's really important that if parents, to your point, if parents understand what it was like before special education laws were enacted, then they really appreciate, like, the you know, the rights that they have now.
Yeah, no, that's, I think, one of the biggest things. When I was in my master's program for special education at, shout out to SUNY Buffalo State, the video, one of my teachers showed us this video, and I think it was Geraldo Rivera, I think. He went in, like, went to this place, and it was like something out of American Horror Story or something. It was just the scariest environment, where they were just funneling all these, you know, what was formerly classified as, I believe, mentally retarded. And, you know, they've, thank God they've changed the terms, and, you know, but just a terrible environment. And, you know, people were sick, you know, it was like inhumane, you know, to the max. And so, yeah, you know, I think that probably was part of the impetus to really, you know, and then there's those pictures of the people, you know, crawling up the Congress stairs who were getting out of their wheelchairs. And there's like this massive, incredible, beautiful, powerful movement. So I like that. I'm excited to read the second edition, where we could dive into more. And I have a couple questions around that, because I feel like, from your position, and one thing we learned about, you know, in my program, but also what you highlight in your book, was that many of these atrocities and these terrible actions have taken place more primarily for the Black community, right? For Black students have, you know, I mean, it's been across the board, but, you know, it seems that oftentimes, and we see this still today, that there's an overclassification of Black students for IEPs as compared to their white peers. And these are very concerning things. And as, you know, a founder of a business that focuses on supporting students with ADHD, often, my understanding is that there's also an under diagnosis of ADHD in the Black community. So I wonder, not only from a personal standpoint, but from a professional standpoint, how has that impacted your work? And also, and this is probably a big answer, but how has that impacted your approach? And do you feel like there's a different approach that needs to be taken to support that community? I'd love to hear just your thoughts on that.
I do. I think I'm going to unpack that a little bit, right? So first, with the over-identification and under-identification, we don't want either, right? So we want to see appropriate identification. And frankly, that starts with assessors and evaluators and professionals who have some kind of cultural sensitivity, right? And understand, you know, the different parenting approaches and different ways and cultural differences, right? In terms of evaluating a child. So, you know, when we take a case, in every case, it doesn't matter, you know, what the ethnic background of the child is, we look very, very closely at that child, right? Not, you know, ADHD in general, but this child, how is it manifesting in this child? And is this child having trouble accessing the general education classroom and curriculum, you know, by virtue of his version of ADHD? Right? Because ADHD, ASD, you know, bipolar disorder, these things can manifest themselves differently in different kids. So first and foremost, I think it's, you know, really looking, being culturally sensitive, but also looking at the individual child, right? And not making these kind of blanket determinations. Also, one example of a cultural sensitivity, right, that I'm personally aware of and dealt with is medication, right? Black folks do not want to medicate their kids. And, you know, that's something that I understand. It's something that I and my husband had to grapple with. And I get it. I get it. But, you know, it depends on what's going on with the child, right? And what kind of medication and the dosage and how old the child is. So there are all these other considerations. So when I speak with parents, I just put it out there. I'm not judging in any way, medication, no medication. You know, by law, the school district cannot force a parent to medicate their child. And I agree with that. So it really, you know, it is an area of sensitivity that I am aware of, and we conduct routine trainings at our firm so that I can make sure all of our other attorneys are aware of this and other cultural differences that we've encountered over the years.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think it's all right. It always goes back to really trying to understand the child and their unique background, and then also trying to be culturally sensitive. And it's so important. And so I want to learn more about those trainings. Are those open to the public, or is that an internal thing only?
You know, it's internal only because we want absolute honesty, right? Like, and so we don't just talk about African-American parents. No, we represent, you know, Muslim parents, you know, Jewish parents. Many of our clients are, you know, Hispanic, Asian. And so we really talk about the cultural differences that we've seen and, you know, how we can do a better job of appreciating those cultural differences and respecting them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an ongoing conversation, but it should be reinforced by a lot of understanding of history. And so that's exciting. I'm sure there's other spinoffs to this. You know, you could probably delve into different avenues to tell the history.
Well, the title of my presentation is From Tiger Mom to Single Dad, right? And so I started this like 10 years ago. And so we explored, you know, notions and misperceptions about the tiger mom. And we also talk about single dads, right? And we started this again 10 years ago when you didn't see many fathers as anchor parents, right? So now we see that more and more. And as a society, we've grown into that. But we as lawyers had to really understand sensitivities around dad being sometimes the only caregiver, but also more and more being an anchor parent.
I wanted to ask about how, you know, I've heard, and I don't know if it's still the case, but, you know, oftentimes, you know, I worked in Marin County as a special educator, and oftentimes it felt and was a shared sentiment among educators there that many times affluent, usually white parents were trying to get their kids into special ed to access additional services for their child. And which also had the, you know, in a factor, I guess the butterfly factor, maybe it's less than the butterfly, you know, more direct effect of reducing the availability of services at times, potentially for students who might have needed them of color or, you know, that weren't able to access them. And I wonder if you could, you know, and then the kind of thought also is that, you know, calling a lawyer is going to be probably an expensive project. How do you deal with that? You know, how do you help parents, you know, and I know this is, you know, it's work, but it's also a labor of love. Could you talk a little bit about how you negotiate that challenge?
So first of all, we, again, sitting there 20 years ago at that IEP meeting, not only did I decide that I was going to be a special education lawyer, I decided that I was going to represent low-income parents. So I went to my boss at DreamWorks, and she's the general counsel. I'm like, okay, I know you're going to be suspect about this, but I want to be a special education lawyer. I'm going to quit my job. And she's like, what? So she extended my contract for just a year, and she allowed me to work from home on Fridays so that I could develop a business plan. And that's what I did. And so the way Adams ESQ works is that we charge a dollar to our parents, right? And again, predominantly low-income parents that we represent. During COVID, we expanded that a little bit to struggling parents, right? Any parents who are struggling, like, we don't charge you a dollar. And then if we're successful in the case, and only if we're successful, then the school district has to pay our legal fees. So at that time, to my knowledge, we were the first law firm to have that model. And obviously, you know, we've been somewhat successful because we're still in business today and have six offices in two states. With respect to the notion that, you know, high income parents want to take advantage of the system, you know, I'm sure that could happen. That is not my experience, not at all. Right? I've literally talked to billionaires, and they're not trying to play the system. They just were like me. They didn't know, they didn't understand, and they don't know what to do, and they don't know how to navigate the system. So in that respect, the income level doesn't matter. And disability, frankly, does not see income level, right? It just is not a factor as to generally, sometimes with mental health, but generally, it's not that much of a factor. I always say that disability is the only minority group that anybody can join at any time. Right? You can walk across the street and get hit by a car, which happened to me, and bam, right? You're disabled. So, it's not necessarily something that there's like a different kind of law for rich folk and a different kind for poor folk. There are different challenges, absolutely. But I bristle, right, at the notion that, you know, parents are just trying to get special ed so they can get their kid into the right college. Like, it could happen, but that's not.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And I feel a little bad that I even brought that idea up. I don't know if it's true. And in my experience,
I've heard it.
Yeah.
Heard
and in it. My experience, yeah. It's not really true. I've never really, you know, thinking back on my experiences with families, like every time I've worked with someone, it's because the challenge, the disability was real. And, you know, we needed to come up with a plan, and it didn't matter if they were, you know, and some of them were extremely wealthy and others were not.
We had a case, and I can talk about it because it was in district court. We represented twins who, had been molested, right? And, you know, they were in really bad shape, and we were able to get them services and help, and the school district appealed, right? And we're like, why did you appeal? Like, you know, these kids obviously needed help. Their mom was, you know, a recovering drug addict, and it was a bad situation. And on appeal in front of a district court judge, the school district argued, well, you know, we can't just let everybody be eligible for special ed because, you know, they're just trying to do it to get better grades, you know, to get into college. And I'm like, Your Honor, like, first of all, these kids are seven, right? They've just been reunified with their parent who's a recovering drug addict, right? This has nothing to do with getting better grades to get into Princeton. Like, it's like, this is not that reality. So yeah, to some extent, you know, I hear that, but I think it is just something, you know, that sometimes lawyers make up.
I've been in a lot of these meetings with lawyers, and it seems like sometimes the district just decides, it's like they put their foot down, you know, regardless of how clear the evidence is that the kid needs specialized services. It's like, you know what, today we're going to just hold our line and battle this, even though it's, which is, I don't know. Yeah, it's comes with the territory.
And I want to be clear. I do respect the district's role and district attorney's roles as gatekeepers. Right. I respect that because we are dealing with public funds. Right. These are tax dollars. This is our money. Right. And so you want those tax dollars to be used wisely. And to the extent that the district and special ed administrators are acting appropriately as gatekeepers, like, I'm 100% for that.
Yeah. I guess it's just a question of, you know, and it's probably a small world, and or maybe they don't know you or do know you. But if you're on the case and you did it for a dollar, it's because you believe in it, right? It's like, you're not there because you want to make a bunch of money. You're like, no, this, you know, I've taken this case. So there should be some consideration of that before you spend tax dollars to bring the school's attorney into the case to battle out, you know, when someone's doing it basically out of the generosity of their heart. But that is a great point. We do have to be very cautious and thoughtful about, you know, the utilization of that. I just have a, like, kind of a simple question here, but, like, you know, you're clearly good at winning an argument. What are the keys, you know, what do you see as the keys to really making your point? And I don't want to say winning, but it is kind of winning, you know, making your case and being heard and getting what's needed. Like, what do you find to be the keys, strategies, you know, as a lawyer?
People think that we win the case when we go to court, right? And have a hearing and have a judge decide. I don't look at it that way. I look at it as winning the case when I first speak with the parent, when I first review the assessments, and when I first review the IEPs, right? If the assessments are accurate, they're good, they're done by, you know, culturally sensitive, you know, knowledgeable folks, they've taken into consideration, you know, all this information, there's been response to intervention, they've looked at all this stuff, they've shared information with the parent, okay, good. Then I would look at the IEP. Does the IEP reflect, right, the needs, the strengths and weaknesses that were set forth in the assessments? If that answer is yes, okay, was that IEP implemented appropriately? If that answer is yes, then that's probably not a case I'm going to take, right? Because at every step, the school district has followed the law. But if the district failed to assess, right, or they assess, but did what I call a drive-by assessment, where it's like really fast and not appropriate, then you can't have, by definition, you cannot have an IEP that affords FAPE, right? Because, you know, you're starting out with a bad assessment, right? And so, or no assessment, right? And so, and then you can't have, even if a teacher's great and trying to do their best, you're probably not going to have FAPE, because a free appropriate public education, because you got an inappropriate IEP based on inappropriate or incomplete assessments, right? So I make that determination at the beginning of the case. Right? I don't need a judge to tell me that this is a righteous case. After 20 years, I can kind of tell, right? And so maybe a judge will agree, maybe they won't agree, but I kind of know from the beginning, you know, there was a problem here. There was a legal problem, and the district really should solve it.
You know, as the founder of a business that supports students with special needs, a lot of my business comes from attorneys, you know, who are trying to support the student, but the family doesn't want to just, you know, wait until they get a settlement and things change, right? They're like, I have to help my kid, you know, so that's where a lot of my business comes from. And I wonder if you could share a little bit about what you look for when you make recommendations to a family, like, hey, in the meantime, you're going to want to get this, this, and this in place because they're not doing that. You know, when you're fighting for that, what do you look for in terms of making recommendations?
First of all, because we represent low-income parents, they typically do not have the means, right, to have educational therapy while the case is pending. So what we've done there is try to move our cases through pretty quickly, right? And then work with them to identify potential educational therapists once we're able to resolve the case with the school district, right? And so, you know, geographically, from a transportation standpoint, like, we're dealing with basic things here. Like, can you get from your kid from A to B so that they can take advantage of this? So those are the things that I look for first, right? Is does this make a practical sense? If we work really hard, you know, will the child be able to take advantage of this service that we fought so hard to get? And you'd be surprised to know that, like, the challenges that parents have to go through in order to, you know, realize on those comp ed services. In terms of what we look for in educational therapists, we look for what is appropriate for the child, right? And so we don't look so much at methodology, you know, like Orton-Gilliam versus Sande versus this or that, but you know, we look to the assessors, right? Remember, those assessments are important. And we look to, you know, what was recommended by assessors, you know, what was needed. You know, we look at whether or not the child can access the educational therapy from a behavioral perspective, right? They might not be in a behavioral space where they actually can physically attend, like, you know, in their brain and physically, right? And so we look at all of those things. We look at availability of the educational therapist. How long have they been in business, right? Are they responsive? What have other parents said, right? Are there any Spanish speakers, right, in terms of the therapists and the support staff? So those are the things that, you know, our law firm looks for in companies and service providers, not just for educational therapy, but also for speech, OT, behavior, other services.
Those are all great considerations. I know a lot of people listening to the show are educational therapists or tutors, and so they're looking to build connections with people like yourself. So listen up closely, rewind that, press that 30-second back button a couple times, and think about what you just heard. So you've clearly exemplified so much genius in being able to serve the needs while also, you know, living the life that you want. Like, it's a beautiful thing. I always talk about this thing called the ikigai, I think is the Japanese concept of, like, what do you love doing? What does the world need? What are you good at? What can you get paid for? And it's like, it sounds like you've really found that kind of, like, center, you know, circle.
Well, you know, I told you my story, so I didn't find it. It found me. But I remember, this reminds me, this is my only time I'm going to tell a Spielberg story. But I'm sitting in Steven Spielberg's office, right? And he's saying, oh, you know, I dream for a living. And I'm looking at him thinking, well, that's real nice. I don't, right? Like, I love this job, but... So I help people for a living, right? And every morning when I get up, I can't wait to get started. Like, this is my life. And yeah, I have a good life, right? I think that it is possible to do good and do well. It is important to have sustainability in any business. You know this, right? You have to have income. You have to be funded. And that's what a business is, right? And so because I'm very passionate about what I do, I'm also pretty passionate about getting paid for it, right? By school districts. In the beginning, it was tough, right? And so, especially because we had this new kind of business model, but it's again, I just felt, and my passion has just grown, right, as the years have gone by. And so I'm very serious, right, about upholding the law, and it is a parent's right to be reimbursed for their legal fees if they're successful in the case. And, you know, I'm very, very firm, right, on exercising that right.
That's one thing I wanted to just float out here. Is one thing I'm trying to figure out is, like, with our services, like, being, I'm an educational therapist and some of my team members are as well, and a credentialed special ed teacher. We want to provide these services like you do. Like, you give us a dollar, we'll serve your kid for the school year. It's hard though, because we don't, you know, it's, and so we're trying to figure that out. That's like a constant thing we're talking about as a team. Like, how do we provide these for everybody, you know, or equitably?
It, you know, it really is a challenge because, again, I'm a lawyer, but I'm also a businesswoman. And you just have to pay attention to profit and loss, balance sheets, accounts receivables. Like, you have to. And so what other educational therapists have done is, you know, they'll have like a foundation and some of their wealthier clients and others will be able to contribute to the foundation, and that helps others, right? Or you say, you look at your bottom line and say, okay, I can afford to do 5%, right? Gratis. You know, that's one way to do it. Working with attorneys, you know, and providing services free, right, and then hoping that the school district will reimburse is risky, right, for educational therapists, especially if you're not kind of big enough to absorb some losses. So that's probably not a strategy I would recommend for individuals or smaller companies.
We're getting near the end, and I wanted to ask you a couple questions. First off, you know, what is the biggest challenge you're facing? It seems like you've done a lot and you've reached a lot of goals you set up for yourself. But what is the biggest challenge you're facing right now?
I am very frustrated. I am very frustrated. The pandemic has just, you know, just wreaked havoc in the lives of so many people. As of yesterday, the day before, 788,000 folks in the U.S. alone have died from this pandemic. And think of all those parents, right, grandparents who have left children behind. And those children need help. My biggest frustration right now is that here in the great state of California, funds have been allocated to help children, right? Almost $500 million who have, you know, children with special needs, right, who have suffered or lost services because of the pandemic, and parents just aren't accessing those funds. I'm not mad. You don't see steam coming out of my ears, but I am frustrated that that funding is available and that parents just aren't accessing it.
How do they access them? What do they need to do?
Ask. They need to ask. Right. So they can identify educational therapists like you. Okay. Found an educational therapist during the pandemic from school closures, March 2020 through, you know, August 2021. My child did not receive anything or received something, but it wasn't helpful. And I want an educational therapist and I want you to pay for it, school district. Right. So what many districts are doing now is that they're negotiating these settlement agreements with parents. Perfectly fine. They can include it in an IEP. Great. The one thing that I would advise parents is you don't see them, but school districts, like behind that door, they have all these like lawyers stacked up. And so before you sign away your rights, just have a lawyer like us take a look at it. We'll do it for free.
If people want to learn more about that specific process around hiring an educational therapist, requesting reimbursement, where can they go? Is that a blog article? I know I've been tracking many of your blog articles and they've been really helpful. But where should they reach out directly? Should they check out your blog? Where do they go?
Well, I think I will just have to write a blog article. So I will there we go. Yeah, that's next week. You know, on how to access.
I was like, yeah, there we go. I can't wait to see that. I've got some rapid fire questions. We call it the hot seat. Can I ask you them?
All right. Woo!
All right. So last movie you saw.
Last movie I saw. I don't know the name of it. It's, you know, it's Christmas time, right? This season. And so there are a lot of these Hallmark type movies. And since George Floyd, you know, and that terrible tragedy, we've just seen so much more diversity in these Hallmark movies that I am just hooked, right? I never watched them in the past, but now I'm just seeing, and now they're all kind of blending into each other. So it was definitely a diverse Hallmark Christmas movie.
Cool. Yeah, I think I definitely have been noticing that too, and I've been excited to watch them. My daughter is 2.5, so I'm like, it's got to be G. Can't do a PG yet, you know.
Feliz Navidad, like,
yeah,
cute, like I love that.
There we go. Who would play you in a movie?
I'm going to say Vivica Fox, right? Like, I'll just say Vivica, because she's just spicy. And I'm going to reverse that. The person who I would love to play in a movie is Diana Ross in Mahogany. Like, I would want to play that role. That is my life. And so I would like to play that role.
They just came out with a movie. Didn't they recently come out with a Diana Ross movie? I feel like I was browsing through Hulu or something and I saw it. Did you like it? Did you see it?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, okay. I like that. Okay. I like that you flipped it and you're like, I'm going to play. It's not who's going to play me. Now, I got to say, I can see the movie already. You're sitting in Steven Spielberg's office. He's like, I dream, you know, for a living. And then you're like, and then it tells the story of this incredible service you've created. So I don't know. You might have to, the next venture might be going back to Steven Spielberg and pitching this script or something.
That's funny. Or maybe I can do a Hallmark movie.
Yeah, there you go. That sounds good too. Self-care activity of choice. How do you decompress after all the hard work you're doing?
I train, right? I go to the gym, right? I do weights maybe twice a week. I do water aerobics. I love my girls and water aerobics. And so exercising is like number one for me.
I love exercise too. That's good. It makes everything manageable. Something people wouldn't know about you.
One thing people would probably not know about me is that I am just a Star Trek fanatic.
That's awesome. If you're listening right now, Miss Adams just held up a textbook on Star Trek. I was actually just thinking about watching Star Trek because I've gone through all the Star Wars. And I was like, I need that like kind of galactic space energy in my life. I'm missing that kind of like exploration of the great beyond. So
The Wrath of Khan.
And last one, if they named a book after you, what would the title be?
The Impossible Dream. My mother was the first in her family to graduate from high school. Her mother was a sharecropper and could not read or write. And her mother was enslaved, right? And so, and I'm the first woman in our family to graduate from college and go on to law school. So in, you know, sort of four generations, we've gone from enslavement to, you know, being a professional and giving back. So those dreams were just, it seemed impossible growing up in the inner city, but hey, I'm happy. I'm living my dream. I guess I do dream for a living.
I like that. You ended on that one. That's good. I got a follow-up question. What keeps you going? You know, do you have like a mantra or like what, you know, when things get tough, what helps you keep going and keep, you know, fighting this fight?
I always say that, and things do get tough. They get really tough. Oh, they can be very tough. Especially during the pandemic, schools closed, so our business suffered, you know, of course, during that time frame. But, you know, I'm very, very grateful for the opportunities that I've had, for my country, for my state, right? I'm very grateful for my the ability to practice. And so what keeps me going is remembering that my mother, grandmother, great-grandmother would be very proud.
Thank you for sharing that. Miss Adams, it has been an absolute honor and privilege to have you on this show today. I know that when people listen to this, it's gonna they're gonna learn a lot and be very impacted. So I'm very grateful for you making time today. If people want to follow up with you or check out your blog, tell how can they connect with you?
They can connect with us on our website, www.adamsesq.com. And we're also on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, but at Adams ESQ for Kids.
Do you want a copy of the book I most credit with helping me earn more tutoring? It's called Clockwork, and I give away a free copy each week to a lucky listener. All you have to do is leave a review of the podcast, take a screenshot, and send me your review to info@earnmoretutoring.com with your physical address. I'll randomly select a winner each week. Now go out and earn more tutoring.